Welcome. You are listening to the Park Avenue Synagogue podcast, and this is Rabbi Elliot Cosgrove. While it's better to hear it live, this is the place to catch the latest sermon, conversation, and select program. If you like what you're hearing or want to learn more about our community, check out PASYN.org. And don't forget to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts to get a notification for our next episode. Enjoy and see you in shul. Shabbat shalom. It didn't happen all at once. It took work to shed the names, accents, and customs of our immigrant forebears. But eventually, we did it. An unspoken bargain was struck. What we would lose in our distinctiveness, we would gain in societal acceptance. Once excluded from the halls of power, politics, the professions, and elite campus life, we became creators, defenders, and even funders of those very institutions, from outsiders to insiders in just under 100 years, give or take a generation. We waxed nostalgic about our humble beginnings, like a great-grandmother's tablecloth. The stories from the past made us grateful for our present blessings. In the abstract, we longed for a return to the land. Next year in Jerusalem, we said at the Seder table. In practice, we were no longer homeless. The diaspora was our home now. We had made it. The blessings were real. The going was good. So who could blame us for being shocked to discover that it was all a mirage? A feeling of whiplash, the rug being pulled out from beneath our feet. For the first time in our lives, we were made to feel as the other. How could this be? In our own minds, the line between us and them had long since been blurred. And yet, by dint of our faith, by dint of our fealty to our historic homeland, we were being made to feel not just different, but somehow a threat to the social order. It was a disorienting feeling that morphed quickly into a disquieting and actual fear. People were saying that we were different, that we didn't belong. Turned out, those political, professional, and educational institutions that we believed ourselves to be stakeholders were far less hospitable to us than we thought. All lives, it would seem, mattered, except Jewish ones. Our golden age was over, or maybe it was never so golden after all. The uptick in anti-Semitism was sharp, but far from uniform, came in different expressions. There was a high-minded kind, people spouting hateful ideas cloaked in claims of the public good. And then there was plain old thuggery, violence and the threat of violence against Jewish people and property. Blindsided as we were, though, we didn't have time to become armchair sociologists. We had to respond. We circled the wagons and began to ask ourselves questions we had never asked before. Was this a time to assert our Jewish identities or keep our heads down? Better to fight from within the halls of power or effectuate change from the outside? Dig in or find another home? We had taken our Jewish identity for granted for so long, and now, for the first time in our lives, we began to ask, what kind of Jews did we want to be? Where do we turn for guidance for such a time as this? Today, we announce the new month of Adar, and with it, the countdown to the festival of Purim and the story of Esther. Esther is one of the five scrolls, Megillot, found in the third section of the Hebrew Bible known as Writings or Ketuvim. Not only is Esther one of the most beautifully crafted of all biblical literary creations, but it bears certain features which make it rare, if not unique, in the biblical canon. First, and most obviously, its namesake and main character is a woman, no small thing in the Boys Club of the Bible. Second, and unlike every other book of the Bible, it does not contain the name of God. Third, and most importantly for our purposes, it tells a story of a Jewish community established outside of Israel. Exiled from the land to Babylon in 586 BCE, the Jewish community establishes itself under Nebuchadnezzar, whose empire would itself be conquered in 539 by Persia's Cyrus the Great. Esther tells a tale of how a diaspora Jewish community navigated its status as a distinct minority in the majority culture of Persia's capital, Shushan, a remarkable and remarkably relevant prism by which to understand our present moment. Having deposed of Queen Vashti due to her refusal to appear at the royal banquet, King Ahasuerus issues an edict to bring forth every young maiden for consideration to be the new royal consort. While staged the world over as some sort of Miss Persia beauty pageant, a careful read of the text suggests a more ambiguous and darker possibility. Was this palace call-up voluntary or a summons? For the maidens in question and their families, was it an opportunity for social advancement or a fear-inducing edict akin to Pharaoh's decree against the male children in the Book of Exodus? Not only are both readings plausible, they can actually exist side by side. Fear and opportunity, an occasion to move up in which much had to be given up. And on cue, Esther is introduced. Though her given name is Hadassah, her secular name is Esther, from the Hebrew word astir, meaning I will hide. What Esther is hiding will become evident as the story progresses. Aside from her physical beauty, we learn a few facts about her. First, Esther was orphaned. She is a ward of her foster father, Mordechai. Second, as a maiden in a man's world, her destiny is not her own. Summoned by the king and at the direction of Mordechai, she has entered into the royal pageant. Third, and perhaps most significantly, she's a member of the Jewish community. Mordechai is actually the first person in the Bible to be called a Jew. In Hebrew, Yehudi refers to one descended from the tribe or land of Yehudah or Judah. Prior to exile, there were no such distinctions between one's national and religious identity. Only in the diaspora would Jews grapple with the complexities of their identity. Citizens of their host country, distinct as a people, with their gaze ever directed to an ancestral land. One senses that Esther's orphan status was not just biological. Separated from her land and family of origin, she was Jew-ish, a Judean exile in King Ahasuerus's court. When Esther enters into the king's palace for consideration, Mordechai advises her to keep her Jewishness secret. Why she must do so, he never states. But Esther understands that her life will be easier or safer or both if she hides her identity. Was it easy or hard for Esther to keep her secret? Did she do so out of duress or out of a desire for advancement? The text never really says. What the text does say that is in the months to come, the transformation in her identity would be beyond anything she could have imagined. 12 months of oil and myrrh, perfumes and cosmetics, a makeover process worthy of the best and worst of reality TV. Esther's transformation enables her to upwardly assimilate into her non-Jewish environs and shed any vestigial traces of her national and religious origins. The fact that Ahasuerus was not just a king, but a non-Jewish king, is the ultimate act of assimilation. Esther had gained so much, but in doing so, she had also left much behind. One wonders how Esther felt when she looked at the mirror and saw a Persian queen looking back at her. She could pass as a non-Jew, an outcome she may have imagined, maybe even dreamt of and feared of, but an outcome that was now her reality. And if the first two chapters of Esther signal the comforts of Persian Jewish life, it's in the third chapter that the bottom falls out. Haman, a descendant of biblical Israel's historic enemy, Agag, is promoted in the king's court. Mordecai refuses to bow down to Haman, having just advised Esther to conceal her identity. Mordecai's refusal to kneel is perplexing. After all, Mordecai's actions become a reflection on all Jews and put the entire people in danger. Would a small curtsy as Haman's procession passed really have been so difficult? Uneasy as we were at Esther's immersion into her Persian identity, we're puzzled at Mordecai's refusal to give even an inch to Persian authority. Neither the choices of Esther or Mordecai are perfect. Both come with a cost and a consequence. Haman's wrath waxes hot. A lot is thrown, a date is set for the destruction of the Jews. Haman brings the matter to the king's attention. There is a certain people, Haman says, scattered and dispersed among the other peoples in all the provinces of your realm, whose laws are different from those of any other people and who do not obey the king's laws. And it is not in your majesty's interest to tolerate them. If it please your majesty, let an edict be drawn up for their destruction. The most significant thing about Haman's words is not what he says, but what he doesn't. He never mentions that the people in question are Jews. A fifth column exists in the kingdom, and Ahasuerus, operating either out of willed ignorance or political expediency, gives a green light for them to be destroyed. As news of the edict spreads throughout the kingdom, we read that the city of Shushan was dumbfounded. Shushan's general population do not seem to bear the same Jew hatred as Haman, but it would take a rare form of courage for an everyday Persian to object to him, a fact which Haman was probably counting on. The virus of anti-Semitism needs only one point of entry to spread systemically. Haman understood that his hatred, combined with the king's enabling and a nation of bystanders, was all that he needed to carry out his dastardly plans. The decisive turning point arrives in the fourth chapter. Mordecai relays the ominous news of Haman's edict to Esther, imploring her to appeal to the king and plead on behalf of her people. Esther hedges, sending a message back to Mordecai that on penalty of death, she cannot enter the king's presence. And Mordecai sends back a forceful reply. Do not imagine that you, of all Jews, will escape with your life by being in the king's palace. If you keep silent in this moment, relief and deliverance will come to the Jews from another quarter, while you and your father's house will perish. And who knows, perhaps you have attained to a royal position for just such a time as this. Mordecai's rhetoric seeks to persuade Esther on a number of levels. Invoking the pull of peoplehood, Mordecai links Esther's fate to that of her imperiled contemporaries and to her ancestral roots. Like Moses, who from the comfort of Pharaoh's palace came to identify with his oppressed kin, so too must Esther. Mordecai makes clear that her fate was tied to all the Jews. Her identity would eventually come out, and even her royal status would not offer protection. Both she and her father's house would be wiped from the earth. The judgment of history, Mordecai argues, was upon her. Should she remain silent, the Jews will be saved from another quarter, but her inglorious inaction would be remembered. Esther knows that Mordecai knows that they both know that but for the chance events of the prior chapter, she would not be sitting on the royal throne. Who knows if it was not for just such a time as this that Esther arrived at her station in life. Now was a time for moral courage. And for the first time in Esther's life, she becomes the protagonist of her eponymous tale. She issues instructions to Mordecai to assemble all the Jews to fast. In breach of protocol and at great personal risk, she seeks an audience with the king. She may perish, but she will no longer keep her identity, Nistar, hidden. Esther has come out of the shadows, a Jew, a woman, and a queen, leaning into all three aspects of her being, a heroine for her time, a heroine for our time. Esther's persona stands as an enduring parable for Jewish identity. The inchoate nature of her early Jewish self, the bargain she makes in entering Persian society, we see our story in hers. So too, the whiplash of discovering the precarious nature of diaspora existence with its combination of haters, enablers, and bystanders, that too strikes close to home. We feel for Esther as she squirms in her indecision. Is this really my fight? I could lose so much, even my life. Besides, who am I to turn the tide of history? Esther's struggle is very much our own struggle. And it is to Esther to whom we turn for direction on what it means to be a Jew today. Esther risks it all: power, popularity, prestige, and social acceptance. She risks her own life for the life of her people. Esther did not choose her moment. It chose her. Purim is all about chance. But when it did, she put herself on the line. She threw her lot in with her people, and she rallied to action, bold, intrepid, and fearless. She is unapologetic about her roots, about her station in life, and about the right of her people to stand tall as both citizens and as Jews. Most of all, she refuses to let her identity and Jewish identity be defined by the hatred of others. Kimu vekiblu ha-Yehudim, the Jews affirmed and accepted, the text notes in a later chapter, a comment understood by the rabbis to signal a joyful and volitional acceptance of Jewish identity. Esther the person and Esther the book are important not merely because it teaches about fighting Jew hatred. It is important because it teaches that Jew haters do not get to define the Jewishness of Jews. Jews do. And we choose to do so by way of Ora, Vesimcha, Vesason, Vikar, light, joy, gladness, and honor. Ours is an Esther moment. We too have made bargains with modernity. We too have adapted to our host culture, only to discover that we were not quite as at home as we thought we were. Who knows if it was not for just such a moment that we arrived at our station in life? We can't know for sure, but we dare not risk being on the wrong side of the question. Some things are better not left to chance. Today and every day, as Esther before us, may we stand connected to our people, vigilant on behalf of their well-being, and most of all, living proud, joyful, and honorable Jewish lives. Shabbat Shalom. Thank you for listening to the Park Avenue Synagogue podcast. If you enjoyed this episode and want to learn more about our community, check out PASYN.org. See you in shul. Hallelujah. Hallelujah. Hallelujah.